Bhairav Mehta talks on the Pith Sutra.
This discourse, which is known as the greater discourse on the simile of the Pith, the Mahasarotha Mama Sutta, was delivered after the schism caused by Devadatta, who wanted to lead the order, the Sangha. And of course, the Buddha had to decline, resigning his position. Devadatta left the Sangha together with 500 other monks. And shortly afterwards, when the Buddha was staying at the Vulture Peak, as it is known, Gijjakuta, near the city of Rajagaha, he delivered this discourse. We must bear this point in mind because there are slight differences from the way in which he presented this discourse and the way in which he presented another discourse, which is called the lesser discourse, the Chula Saropama Sutta. Now, at one time the Lord was staying near Rajagaha on Mount Vulture Peak, not long after Devadatta had left the order. That's how it starts. And the Lord plunges straight away into the subject. Here, monks, some young man of family has gone forth from home into homelessness. Let us understand also, home into homelessness means from the family, from the familiar to the unfamiliar. It's useful to bear that in mind. He goes away through faith and thinks, I am beset by birth, aging and dying, grief, sorrow, lamentation and so on. I am beset by anguish, overwhelmed by anguish. Maybe the annihilation of this whole mass of anguish can be shown. He starts his discipline. And when he starts his discipline, he gains he receives gains, honors, and fame. These gains simply mean his alms food and his robes and his necessities of existence. They are given unto him by the village folk, or he picks out rags from the rag heap and washes them, sews them together. Those are his gains. Honor, certainly, because everyone in the village or the town pays him respect. Usually, not always. The Buddha himself sometimes was reviled by the householders. But usually he is paid great respect and he achieves a certain degree of fame because he is an almsman, a bhikkhu. Because of these gains, honors, and fame, he becomes satisfied. He feels his purpose is fulfilled. Consequently, he exalts himself. All his ordinary defilements are still in him. He disparages others, saying, it is I who am the recipient, being famous. But those other monks are little known, of little esteem. Now, because of these gains, honors, and fame, labha sakara siloka, the three are lumped together under the one word. Because of these, he becomes exultant, indolent, and falls into slothful ways, neglects the discipline, in other words. Being indolent, he dwells in the ill state, says the Lord. Then he goes on to say, monks, it is like a man walking about, aiming at the pit, seeking for the pit, looking about for the pit of a great, stable, and pithy tree. He passes by the pit itself, passes by the softwood, passes by the bark, passes by the young shoots, and who, having cut down the branches and foliage, might go away taking them with him, thinking they were the pith. Note the 5 points mentioned: branches and foliage, young shoots, bark, softwood, and pith. Now, a man with vision, says the Lord, having seen him, might say, indeed, this good man does not know the pith. He does not know the softwood, the bark, the young shoots. He does not know the branches and foliage. Note very carefully, he's gone away with the branches and foliage. But the Lord says he does not know the branches and foliage. And the Lord goes on talking in that way, and he compares the branches and foliage to gains, honors, and fame, the labha sakara siloka. And the Lord makes it clear that he does not know all of these, including the branches and foliage, simply because he has not obtained the pith. This is the very significant point. And because of this failure, he fails of full accomplishment, the failure to see and know the pith. Then he goes on in the same manner, pointing out that a young man of family leaves home, etc., takes up the discipline. He, gone forth thus, receives gains, honors, fame. Because of these, he does not become satisfied like the first man did. His purpose is not fulfilled. Because of these gains, honors, and fame, the branches and foliage, he does not exalt himself. He does not disparage others. He is not exultant, not indolent, does not fall into sloth. Being diligent, he attains success in moral habit. But because of this success in moral habit, the second stage, he becomes satisfied, he thinks his purpose is fulfilled, he exalts himself, disparages others, and he is exultant, indolent, and falls into sloth. And a wise man looking at him will say, this good man knows the branches and foliage of the tree. He knows the young shoots, the success in moral habit, living the moral life according to the sila, the rules of the sila. See? These are the young shoots. So he has obtained those, He has not obtained the pith, and the Lord points out that because he has not obtained the pith, he has not got anything at all. The third stage, of course, the same formula is repeated, and he comes to success in meditation, in samadhi, concentration, if you like, training of the mind. And he thinks that this is all there is. He becomes indolent, and the Lord says he remains in a state of ill because he has not got the pith. And the success in samadhi is compared with the bark of the tree. And the next step is where another one comes along, attains success in the previous three, and now adds a fourth: knowledge and vision. Jnana dasana. One may inquire, what is this knowledge and vision which is referred to? A previous sutta gives us the key to that. It is the sutta which is known as the relay of chariots, the Ratha Vinita Sutta, Ratha Vinita Sutta. And there is a conversation with Punna, who was the son of Mantani, with Sariputta. And in this conversation, Punna inquires, then, your reverence, is this Brahma-faring, the holy life, lived under the Lord for the sake of purity of knowledge and insight into the way and what is not the way? That is the knowledge and vision referred to. And that is compared with the softwood of the tree. But because he obtains release that way, he again falls into sloth, and therefore is in a state of ill. He has not yet obtained the pith. And the pith is the really important thing here. Then there comes another one who goes through all these stages, and he does not become exultant, indolent, and so forth as a result of obtaining knowledge and vision. But he strides on, and finally he obtains the pith. And when he obtains the pith, which is the thing that he's really looking for, the Lord says that he, being diligent, obtains release as to things of time. That is how it is translated. The Pali word used is samaya vimokkha. Samaya vimokkha. But this samaya vimokkha is release according to the time and circumstance. According to the time and circumstance. It is still a conditioned state. It is dependent upon a favorable prevailing situation. You know how it is in our own experience. There are times when we are top of our form and everything seems to go well and everything has come out right. But it doesn't last. One falls away from that harmonious, beautiful, sublime or exalted state, falls back into conflict, into confusion, and so forth, into experience, reactions, of greed, of malevolence, jealousy, and so on. So he falls back from this Samaya Vimokkha. Now, one of the commentaries on the Majjhima suggests that the Samaya Vimokkha refers to being able to enter the four jhanas and the four samapattis, the immaterial abidings as they are called. Which is a little bit questioning. It is a little bit questionable whether this is actually the case. But we'll enter into that a little bit later. So now, the important point to remember is that until the pith is obtained, the monk is unable to obtain the good in each of the previous four. So let us recapitulate: gains, honors, fame, which come to him from outside; success in the silas, in samadhi, in knowledge and vision regarding the way and the fruits of the way; and finally, with the pith, he obtains conditional release, namely release as to things of time, a temporal release. But what precisely is the pith compared to is not stated in this particular discourse. What is this pith? Here, let us go into the Mahavagga. After the enlightenment, when one by one his great disciples to be come to him. First of all, of course, he speaks to the five who were his companions in austerity before the enlightenment, one of whom was named Asvaji. Now, the account given in the Mahavagga is as follows. A teacher called Sanjaya was staying at Rajagaha together with a great company, 250 disciples. At that time, Sariputta and Moggallana were the disciples of Sanjaya. And they made a pact with each other that whichever one of them realized the deathless first would announce it to the other. Now at that time, Asaji entered Rajagaha for alms food. He was pleasing to look at, whether he was approaching or departing, or whether he was looking in front or looking behind. His eyes were cast down. He was possessed of pleasant behavior. Sariputta saw Asaji walking for alms food, observed his appearance and his demeanor, and it occurred to Sariputta, this is one of those monks who are indeed perfected ones in the world, or who have entered on the way to perfection. So Sariputta decides that when it is the right time to question this monk, he doesn't rush up to him immediately and say, "Hey, Sariputta." You see, he waits until the right time comes for questioning and then approaches him. They exchange the usual greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. I think this is one of the most charming aspects of the accounts given in all these discourses. It is always said how they exchange the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. A human relationship is being formed. Each person as a person is respected for what he is. The person is not invalidated. See, there's a very deep significance in this. And Sariputta speaks thus, "Your reverence, your faculties are quite pure. Your complexion very bright, very clear. On account of whom, your reverence, have you gone forth? Or who is your teacher? Or whose Dhamma do you profess? And Assaji answered, there is, O friend, a great recluse, a son of the Sakyans, gone forth from a Sakyan family. I have gone forth on account of this Lord, and this Lord is my teacher, and I profess this Lord's Dhamma. Sariputta asks, but what is the doctrine of your reverence's teacher? What does he point out? And Assaji answers, I, friend, am new, not long gone forth, fresh to this Dhamma and discipline. I am not able to teach you Dhamma in full, but I can tell you its purport briefly. Then Sariputta said, so be it, your reverence. Tell me little or tell me much, but in any case, explain to me its purport. I want just its purport. Why should you make a great elaboration? Then the Venerable Assaji uttered this terse expression of Dhamma to the wanderer Sariputta. Those things which proceed from a cause, of these the truth finder has told the cause, and also told that which is their stopping. The great recluse has such a doctrine. Let us look at this word things, those things which proceed from a cause. The word used is Dhamma, the plural of Dhamma. Now Dhamma has a straightforward meaning, the doctrine, the truth, etc. But Dhamma has a large number of meanings. The word things is one meaning. But I feel that the meaning we should apply in this context is mental states. Those mental states which proceed from a cause, of these the truth finder has told the cause. Why should we lay emphasis on the mental states? Because if there is no mind, there is no joy, no sorrow. There is no registration of pain or pleasure. The mind is of fundamental importance in the life of man. The very word man is derived from the Sanskrit root, which implies mind. Man is a mind creature, and the mind and his mental states are the really important thing. It is the mind that is full of defilements. It is the mind that becomes holy, pure, and virtuous. So, those states of mind which proceed from a cause, he doesn't specify whether those states are just good states or bad states, as we call them. All states of the mind which proceed from a cause, of these the truth finder has told the cause. Now, this is extremely significant. Neither the good states nor the bad states are of any special importance as such. Although in the discipline one tries to become free of the ill states and to make grow, as it is said in the Pali, the good states. All states of mind are impermanent. They are relative. They are not the absolute reality. So the mind has to undergo that discipline by which ultimately it will be completely empty. and therefore utterly transparent to the transcendent reality, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. This is why. Therefore, the cause must be something which contributes towards the born, the becoming, the dying, and so forth, to the relative, the anicca, which is associated with dukkha. Very good. Now, the words in the Pali are ye dhamma hetuppabhava. Ye dhamma hetuppabhava. Those mental states which produce from a cause, the truth finder has told the cause. What is the cause? Look at the second noble truth. The cause of all ill, of all these mental states, is tanha, the thirst for sentient existence. That is the cause. And this is what the Lord teaches. And this is what Asaji has gathered from the Lord. Tanha as the cause of all these temporal mental states which keep us in the condition of ambivalence, which means conflict and ill. And the Lord teaches they are stopping. Let us not understand this stopping as a forcible stopping by will, by effort, and so forth. Effort, of course, will be there, the right sort of effort. But not the effort which is a fight against ill. One never realizes what there is to be realized by fighting against it. Remember how Jesus also said, resist not evil. Profound statement, but little understood by people. They are stopping. Nirodha. They are fading away. The fading away of these mental states. And the fading away not merely of the mental states, but of the cause, the tanha, the clinging, the passion, the thirst for sentient existence. And the fourth truth, as you know, is the third truth is the extinction of the cause, the disappearance of the cause, and the fourth is the way, which is called the middle way. But that word middle again is very misleading. It is the transcendent way, because his middle way, when set out, says perfect understanding, perfect aspiration, perfect speech, perfect hope, perfect mode of living, sama ajivo, usually translated as right livelihood, means of livelihood. But don't confine it to livelihood. Perfect living in every respect. Sama ajivo. Sama kama vayamo. Perfect endeavor. Sama sati, sama samadhi. Perfect mindfulness, perfect communion. This is the way of transcendence. This is not a middle. Supposing we look at it this way. Let's draw a line like this. At either end, we have indulgence on the one hand, you see, and we have painful austerity on the other, repression on the other. All right. This is our life here in the world, oscillating between the two extremes. Whether we are at this end, we are kicked, or whether we are at that end, we are knocked on the head. So there you are, both ways you get it. You see, this is our life here. All right, what is this perfect middle way? Is it in the middle of this line, staying in the middle of the line, and spending your life just trying to balance between God and the devil? The devil has 100-to-1 chance he'll get you. No. The perfect way, straight up there, now draw two lines up there to the apex. The apex which is lost in the zenith of transcendence itself. That is the perfect way. And that is the middle way. It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Middle, more in the sense of poised. Not in the sense, don't think of it in terms of a distance. Poised. Now the first and the second truths are worldly truths. All that we undergo here in the world. And the cause of it is a worldly cause, our passion for sentient existence. But the complete disappearance of this passion for sentient existence and the perfect way are transcendent truths. They are not worldly truths. This is a very important thing to bear in mind. The healing can never come from the plane of the disease. It has to come from a transcendent level, a transcendent depth. So now, this is the pit, as Asvati says, that the Lord has pointed out, that all those states which spring from a cause, of these, the cause is Tanha, and they are stopping, they are Nirodha, is, and the way to that Nirodha, he also teaches. Thereupon, Sariputta, when he hears this, in him there arose Dhamma vision, dustless, stainless, that whatsoever is of the nature to uprise, all that is of the nature to stop. And because we cling to that which has uprisen and want to keep it as such, make it a fixation, we suffer. Right. Then Sariputta tells Moggallana about it, and both of them go immediately to the Lord and become two of his greatest disciples. So that's the pit. Now let us come back to the text. The Buddha goes on in our discourse saying that he obtains samaya vimokkha, release as to things of time. The situation occurs, monks, when the monk falls away from freedom as to things of time. Then he repeats the whole thing again. Of another monk who comes along, obtains knowledge and vision, comes to the stage of knowledge and vision, and then he says, because of this knowledge and vision, he becomes satisfied, but not yet is his purpose fulfilled. He does not exalt himself, does not disparage others, he is not exultant, indolent, and he does not fall into sloth. Being diligent, he obtains release as to things that are timeless. Now there's a big gap here something has been definitely left out. In the previous case, he says he obtains release as to things of time. And then here, he says no more as to how he obtains the release that is timeless. Doesn't say anything about it in this discourse. And he goes on to say, so it is, man, that this Brahma-faring is not for advantage in gains, honors, fame, moral habit, concentration, knowledge and vision. That which is unshakable freedom of mind, akuppa cheto vimutti, unshakable, akuppa, unshakable freedom of mind. This is the goal of this Brahma-faring. This the pith, this the culmination. It's strange that in the great discourse he doesn't say it. And remember that the great discourse was given after Devadatta left. And it was given to the assembled monks in general. It is quite possible that because most of those monks knew theoretically the steps which led to the timeless, he did not mention it in this case. I think that is most probably the real reason why it is not mentioned. But in the next discourse, the Chula Sarupama Sutta, we have a slightly different situation. A Brahmin called Pingala Kocha. Now, Pingala means tawny. Kocha was his name. So Kocha approaches the Lord and he asks a question. Good Gotama, he says, those who are leaders in religious life, heads of companies, etc., and he mentions them. Purana Kassapa, Makkali of the cow pen, Makkali Gosala, as he was known, Adita of the hair blanket, Kesa Kembalin, Pakudda Kachayana, Sandhya, Belatha's son, again, Nigantha, Nitha's son. Did all these teachers, according to their own assertion, understand, or did they not all understand? Or did some understand, and did some not understand? That is to say, the truth. Enough, Brahman, says the Buddha, let this be. It really isn't important what the other fellows did. I will teach you Dhamma, Brahman. Brahman, listen to it, attend carefully, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, the Brahman Pingalakocha answered the Lord in assent. Then the Lord straightaway plunges into, it is like a man walking about aiming for the pit and so forth. And he goes through the same recital as in the previous sutta in a slightly shorter form. And then he goes on to say, that after attaining knowledge and vision, knowing that his purpose is not yet fulfilled, he develops a desire for chanda. Chanda, desire means a passionate energy to realize truth. That's what chanda means. Not desire in the ordinary meaning of the word. And strives for realizing those other things. The word here is things, in the text it is dhamma. Those other states of mind and consciousness. This is what we must remember. Which are higher and more excellent than knowledge and vision. He does not become remiss or lax. Now, what are these other higher states? And the Buddha goes on to retail the various jhanas and the samapattis. You see the importance of these jhanas and samapatis. These are the deepening states of communion, of samadhi, of the true samadhi, by which the self as a separate entity, that is to say, the self, the isolated self-consciousness, is completely transcended. The isolativeness is utter. Then that mind is utterly transparent, and mind in itself, transcendent mind, functions freely through this prepared vessel, this prepared grave, if you like, utterly freely, and there is light. And you know how the Buddha in other discourses says, and then light arose at each step, he says. All right. The important crucial point is here. At the fourth jhana, and as he retails each jhana, he says, this is more excellent, higher than and more excellent than the previous state. Now do not think of these transitions from jhana to jhana as if you are going up a ladder step by step, or entering another sphere, so to say. It is simply this, that your own attentiveness, as it becomes purer and purer, that is to say, free of the intrusion of thoughts, feelings, ideas, conceptions, and so on, becomes more and more intense till it glows at a white heat which does not burn but enlightens, and which is the source of inexhaustible energy and life for you. This is the thing that we all forget. This is what happens, actually. It's not like a school where you go from class 1 to class 2 and class 3. It's not that. It is an intensification here and now of your mode of awareness of totality. Put it that way. And here is the crucial point. And again, Brahmins, this is after being in the fourth jhana, by the going down of perception of sensory reactions, by not attending to perceptions of variety. What is the significance of the going down of all perception of sensory reactions? You remember in our afternoon meetings we have talked about this when considering this question of the shunyata, the emptiness. That the final thing which is not emptiness is the six sense fields and the six sense functions conditioned by life, grounded in this body itself. The Buddha does not repudiate the body at all. In fact, he teaches in other contexts that the body is the indispensable necessary means by which this realization can come into being. If there were no body, there is no Buddhahood possible. The body is the indispensable medium. But this body is the not emptiness, the non-shunyata. Your whole body, including your head, which is right there. And the head is the container of the organs of sense and the brain, without which nothing of this can possibly take place. So don't deny your head or any other part of your body. He enters when the senses, so when the sensory perceptions, the perceptions of sensory impressions and reactions has completely quietened down, This is what I have frequently spoken of as the pacification of the sense function. Not repression, not suppression, but they are complete pacification. So that you are in that state of utter inner poise, where any sense impressions coming from outside will no longer disturb your perfect equanimity, which is not a static condition, but a condition of dynamic poise. You are vibrating, you are thrilling to the utmost extent possible for your own psychophysical being. You're living so fully as that you never live anywhere near so fully in any other state and condition. So the significance of this pacification of the sense and the sense perception. Then he enters into that state of awareness of the infinity of Akasha, which is the root of all manifestation. Prakruti is the word that the Sankhya philosophy used. Akasha is a word that is used both in the Upanishads and by the Buddha. And they use it, as far as I'm aware, in the identical meaning and sense. And then passing on from that to infinite vijnana, consciousness, then to knowing, then to neither perception nor non-perception. Now these are the immaterial states, the four immaterial states of awareness. But this is not the, this is just one leg, so to say, of the realization of freedom. When the monk sees this and understands this clearly, his asavas come to an end. You remember I explained the other day, asavas as the overflows, the overspill of consciousness back into that state where he reacts to sense impressions. He reacts in a manner which raises up again greed, malevolence, ill will, and all the other ills. All that disappears. And he's in that state of utter purity from which he can never fall back again. This is the asamaya vimokkha. This is the timeless state. And this is the real unshakable freedom of mind which is realized. So that is the goal, the pith of the Brahma theory. In this discourse to Satyaka, Agyavesana is another name for him. And I, Agyavesana, he's talking about himself as he gives the speech, as he gives his talk, you see. At the close of such a talk, steady, calm, make one-pointed and concentrate my mind subjectively in that first characteristic of the state of samadhi, in which I ever constantly abide. What is this first characteristic of samadhi? It is the shunyata phala samadhi, the fruit of the emptiness, of having realized the emptiness, which means that the mind is utterly pure at all times, under all conditions, and in all situations. It is utterly transparent. What is it transparent to? The totality. The thou and I separation has vanished forever and ever. It is the touching of nirvana with the body. And think of nirvana not in any sort of pictures of wonderful light or pleasure or happiness or beauty or anything, but think of it in its negative form. The utter disappearance of greed, of hate, of delusion. Its literal meaning, blown out. The blowing out of the fires of greed, hate, delusion. See, it's important to try and sense what is implied in this ascent, as we call it, to nirvana. It is not an ascent. Nirvana just emerges freely. All around is perfection, is beauty. God, in his heaven, as Browning said, all's right with the world. Very difficult to understand when we look at the world with our eyes and see human affairs as they are. We say everything is wrong with the world, and we are right in saying that. But Browning is also right. God's in his heaven, all right with the world. When you yourself are in that state of complete and perfect poise, the shunya safala samadhi, in your ordinary waking consciousness also, that spirit is there. Then your world, the world as you are able to see it, is all right, because you see that this painful, terrible becoming process is the natural consequence of all the causes that are in operation. Then you don't get upset. And if you don't get upset, you cease to rush about trying to do good and generally succeed in making a mess. This is very important. Supposing you're walking in the street, there's an accident and the poor chap is down, the car has hit him and blood is flowing. Now, if you faint at the sight of that blood, you are no use to him whatsoever. You can't help him, can you? Well, don't faint. Be completely poised, cool, collected. This is the kind of thing that the Buddha is trying to put up. Now, so have we understood unconditioned freedom of mind, unshakable freedom of mind? Or are we apoplexic, you see? So, take a leaf out of the Buddha's notebook. Here are trees. Meditate, monks, meditate, so that you give yourselves no cause for remorse after.